Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Progressives won huge victories in Wisconsin and Chicago last night. We're discussing Wisconsin today and Chicago on Friday. Wisconsin voters flipped majority control on the state Supreme Court from conservative to liberal for the first time since 2008. Judge Janet Protasiewicz, a supporter of abortion rights, won her race against Republican-backed Dan Kelly by 10 points. Because of this victory, the court is likely to reverse the state's abortion ban and end the use of gerrymandered Republican-drawn maps. Here is Judge Janet Protasiewicz speaking at last night's victory party.
Just over a year ago, I got into this race. I made the decision because I saw that Wisconsinites were ready for common sense and fairness on their Supreme Court. Thank you, Kathy. They were ready to put aside the partisanship and put aside the extremism and to have an impartial court and a court that makes decisions based on the law, not on a political agenda.
That was Judge Janet Protasiewicz speaking at her victory party last night. Also last night, Ben Wickler, chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, tweeted, "This election was a release valve for 12 years of Democratic rage in Wisconsin about Republicans rigging our state and smashing our democracy, and then using that power to rip away our rights." As today's guest, journalist Ari Berman, reports, Judge Protasiewicz's victory gives progressives their first majority on the court since 2008 and a pathway to challenging the GOP's decade-plus stranglehold on power in the Badger State. Ari Berman is national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones, a fellow at the Type Media Center, and author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari has been reporting on the Wisconsin race. Hi, Ari. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rose. Good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Well, great to have you, Ari. As you say in your articles, this was such an important race. Can you just tell us about the significance of Judge Protasiewicz's victory last night?
It's a huge deal. Usually, state Supreme Court elections, nobody can even name who's running for them, if they even are running in the first place, because in many states, judges are not elected. But in Wisconsin, the state Supreme Court has been incredibly powerful. Basically, they have been a key driver of the GOP's attempts to try to entrench anti-democratic power over the last decade. The policies that have been passed by Scott Walker and the Republican legislature over the last decade, ranging from overturning rights for labor unions, to making it harder to vote, to passing extremely gerrymandered maps, to refusing to change an 1849 abortion ban. Those are all issues that have either been upheld by the Wisconsin Supreme Court or are coming very soon, like in the case of abortion, to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So basically, as long as conservatives have controlled the court and the legislature, it's impossible to have any kind of change in Wisconsin. And so this finally opens up the possibility that there could be change in Wisconsin, which of course is very important nationally because Wisconsin is one of the most contested battleground states in the country. Right now, the state has a Democratic governor. It has voted for Democrats in 14 of the last 17 statewide elections. But basically, Democrats and progressives have no power to change policy in the state because Republicans have had a stranglehold on the legislature through gerrymandering and on the state Supreme Court. So right now, if you have a progressive majority on the state Supreme Court, that opens the door to restoring checks and balances, and more importantly, to restoring the basic democratic process in the state that hasn't really existed for the last decade and a half.
And as you report, this has been the most expensive judicial race in U.S. history. Spending has topped $42 million for a Supreme Court race. That is unprecedented.
It's crazy. I mean, part of it was that it's in 2023, and so there's not a lot of other elections going on. And so there's a lot of people available to give money and to run TV ads and to work on campaigns. But also, I think both sides understood the significance of this. Progressives understood and Democrats understood this was their best chance to flip the state Supreme Court in 15 years. And that would have huge ramifications for redistricting, for voting rights, for abortion, for labor rights, for other issues that could come before the court. And also Republicans realized this was their chance to try to preserve the majority in the court they saw slipping away, because right now the only branch of government that Republicans are going to control come August when Judge Protasiewicz is seated is the legislature. And obviously they're going to do everything they can to try to preserve their majority. But if you don't have the courts and you don't have the governor's office, it's a lot harder to maintain your hold on power. And so basically Wisconsin has been this paradox, Rose. We've talked about this before, that it's this 50-50 state, but it's run as a one-party Republican state. And that just doesn't make any sense. And I think a lot of voters are tired of it. They want to have a two-party state back where people have policies they believe in again, where popular policies can actually pass. Because right now, you have these hugely unpopular policies like the 1849 criminal abortion ban, like the ridiculously gerrymandered maps that the legislature refuses to change. Meanwhile, they're constantly blocking popular policies, whether it's expanding Medicaid or background checks for guns, things like that, from ever becoming law. And so the legislature has just had total domination over the state for over a decade. And I think a lot of people are very frustrated with that.
It's also important, Ari, to point out that a lot of dark money was spent on this race backing Republican Dan Kelly. And so it's really hard to follow the money in some cases, and other cases it's not. But in this case, dark money did not win. And money just controls so much. And I think it's important just to spend a couple minutes on that.
For sure. I mean, it's important to note that Judge Protasiewicz actually raised more money than the conservative judge, Dan Kelly. And so she had a financial advantage. So it wasn't that money didn't matter. It's just that she had more money than he did. But I also think that the Republicans ran kind of a stale playbook. They did spend a tremendous amount of dark money. A lot of it actually came from election deniers and people who had funded the insurrection. They basically attacked Protasiewicz repeatedly as soft on crime in very questionable ways. They ran multiple ads about a rape victim, and the victim came forward and said the ads were inaccurate. They were triggering. They were traumatizing. And that she agreed with the sentence that Judge Protasiewicz, as a judge in Milwaukee, had given to the attacker. And those ads had to be pulled. So it was just so over the top. And people were concerned about other things. And the two things that they were mostly concerned about were abortion rights and repealing the 1849 abortion ban, and the lack of democracy in the state. And those two issues go together. A lot of people think they're separate, but they go together. Because the reason why the legislature refuses to change the 1849 abortion ban is because it's so gerrymandered that they could ignore the will of the voter. So until you restore democracy in Wisconsin, you're not going to restore abortion rights or labor rights or all other rights. And I think that's why the state Supreme Court race is so important, because people feel like there's now a majority in the court that's going to be responsive to the will of the voters in a way that the conservative majority has not been.
Right. And these are huge issues. I mean, abortion has been illegal in Wisconsin since June when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe. It revived Wisconsin's 1849 near total abortion ban. And so according to reports, in the next year, the Supreme Court in Wisconsin will most likely overturn that.
Yeah, it's already working its way through the courts. There's already been a challenge filed by the Democratic Attorney General in Wisconsin to the abortion ban, claiming that it's basically so old that it can't even take effect, that essentially the statute of limitations on the law has expired, and that it needs to be affirmatively passed again for it to actually go into effect. So that's working its way through the courts. I believe it's before the courts in Dane County, where Madison is, and then but it'll eventually go to the state Supreme Court, and it's pretty clear that there's now four votes on the court to overturn it, and other issues could be filed once Judge Protasiewicz is seated in August, including progressive groups have already said that they're going to challenge the redistricting maps the day after she's seated. So that's a challenge that's also going to come before the court. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty between now and August. Republicans in the legislature are already saying they're going to try to potentially impeach Judge Protasiewicz, which, again, would be unprecedented, create a whole nother level of constitutional crisis in Wisconsin. They're also going to try to get her to recuse herself from cases because she took money from the Democratic Party, because she has been outspoken about her views. She has said, without saying how she'll rule on certain cases, but she said that she supports a woman's right to choose. She said that she believes the maps are rigged. I personally found this to be refreshing because I think judges always have ideologies and I think they just pretend that they don't. And conservatives are great at doing this, about talking about things like interpreting the Constitution and then just radically rewriting the Constitution in the ways that they like. And so I thought it was actually refreshing to have a judge basically come out and say, I have values. Here's things I believe in. Here's what I would do. And some people thought it would hurt her. Well, she won by 11 points. So I think voters found that refreshing, that they knew who they would be voting for in a judge. Now, we can debate whether or not judges should be elected in the first place. But the fact is, in Wisconsin, they are. And for a long time, conservatives had an advantage on that. And I think progressives have learned how to catch up.
Let's also talk about gerrymandering, because, again, this could be a huge change. You report that the gerrymandered maps passed by Wisconsin Republicans in 2011 have been the most important factor in their undemocratic grip on power. Drawn in secret at a private law firm across the street from the state capitol, the maps gave Republicans a huge majority of seats, even when they received a minority of votes statewide. And this is such important information. Dan Kelly, then a lawyer in private practice, defended the GOP redistricting effort in federal court. So tell us more about gerrymandering in Wisconsin and what might change now that the liberals have a majority.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that Wisconsin is one of, if not the most gerrymandered state in the country. As I said, Democrats have won 14 of the last 17 statewide elections. In the last election, the Democratic governor got 51% of the vote, but Republicans got 65% of seats in the state assembly and 67% of seats in the state Senate. They just won another state Senate seat last night, very narrowly. And the reason they're getting these giant majorities in a 50-50 state that is leaning Democratic is because they've rigged the maps. And they've drawn the maps in such a surgical way to limit Democratic representation. And so essentially, voters are powerless to change the composition of the legislature. You can change a few votes here, a few votes there. But in 2022, Democrats actually won pretty much every major election in Wisconsin except for the U.S. Senate race, which was very close. They reelected a Democratic governor, a Democratic attorney general, a Democratic secretary of state. But Republicans actually gained seats in the legislature in an otherwise Democratic year in Wisconsin because they drew the maps in such a way to favor their party. And so the Republican Party is shrinking in Wisconsin. The Republican Party is getting fewer votes than Democrats in Wisconsin, but they're getting more seats in the legislature because of gerrymandering. So the only way to change Wisconsin politics is to get rid of these gerrymandered maps. And basically what progressive advocates say they're going to do is they're going to launch a challenge to these maps when the new judge is seated, and they're going to say that gerrymandering violates the Wisconsin Constitution and that it violates numerous provisions of it. And I think that probably there's going to be four justices on the court now that are very sympathetic to that position, because it's not just a theoretical position. We've seen in real time the damage that gerrymandering has done in Wisconsin. Mm.
You point out that there's a very important upcoming Supreme Court case connected to all of this. It's going to rule in the coming months on a case in which Republicans argue that state legislatures should have exclusive power to draw redistricting maps and pass voting rules. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, the case is Moore versus Harper, and basically Republicans are using a very radical argument that basically says that state legislatures should be granted exclusive authority to draw congressional redistricting maps, not state legislative maps, because state legislative maps still have to fall under the state constitution. But they have they should have exclusive authority to draw congressional maps and also to decide how people can and can't vote. I mean, there would be a very radical ahistorical interpretation that would remove checks and balances, but it would also obviously limit what the progressive majority on the state Supreme Court could do. It might make them harder to challenge discriminatory voting laws. It could make it difficult or impossible for them to strike down the state's congressional districts, which currently the congressional delegation is 6-2 Republican, so those districts aren't fair either. But the state Supreme Court would still have the power to strike down the state legislative districts, regardless of what the U.S. Supreme Court does. And I think that's the most important thing, because people are obviously concerned about the congressional maps, but I think the feeling is the GOP has a stranglehold on power because of the state legislative maps that apply to the assembly and to the state Senate. And I think regardless of what the U.S. Supreme Court does, the state Supreme Court would still have jurisdiction over that issue. But again, we'll see what happens. You can never put anything past this current U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. Today, we're speaking with Ari Berman, national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones, a fellow at the Type Media Center and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. For about 10 more minutes, we are going to talk about what happened in Wisconsin last night. Voters flipped majority control on the state Supreme Court from conservative to liberal for the first time since 2008. If you have a question or comment for Ari Berman, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Ted who writes, North Carolina is another state where extreme gerrymandering has helped Republicans build a supermajority, which it's using to ram through several regressive laws. Just yesterday, a Democratic state legislator announced plans to start caucusing with her GOP colleagues, thus undermining Democratic legislative power. What lessons can we learn from the Wisconsin results, and how best can we apply them in North Carolina and other states in order to restore fairness and democracy?
That's a really good question. North Carolina was a state that actually had a more progressive judiciary, where state Supreme Court judges are also elected, but that state in 2022 came under conservative control. So the North Carolina Supreme Court now has a conservative majority. They're likely to reinstate even more gerrymandered maps, and also to possibly put new restrictions on voting in check. And I think it just goes to show you that despite this victory in Wisconsin, conservatives have been very successful at focusing on things like state Supreme Courts. They also flipped a majority in Ohio, too. So that's another state that could green light new gerrymandering. So it isn't like Democrats or progressives all across the country are dominating these state Supreme Court races. I think the lesson is that these races need more attention. I mean, a lot of people decried the level of spending on the Wisconsin Supreme Court race. And I get that we don't want a lot of dark money spent on elections. But the flip side is that a lot of people were aware of the race in a way that they're not usually aware of these races. And these races are incredibly important. So it would be nice if we could strike a balance of making more people aware of these races without having all the dark money and things that goes along with that spending. But I do think it was on balance good for democracy that so many people were aware of the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, that there was such high turnout. That's not usually the case. And that usually what's happened is outside interests, particularly on the conservative side, have been able to funnel a lot of money to these races, and they've been able to win these elections that a lot of people aren't really even that aware of.
Right. You know, Ari, we've spoken to you so many times about gerrymandering, and it's really incredible when you think about what Republicans have been able to pull off because of gerrymandering, implementing so many laws that are not popular, and then refusing to pass laws that are popular. And I'm reminded of what Karl Rove, remember Karl Rove back in 2010? He wrote, "When you draw the lines, you make the rules." Yeah. And that's when the Republicans gained 700 new seats and set the stage for unprecedented gerrymandering. And as you've said, Democrats have been so far behind on this issue, but they've figured it out now. They've caught up. They're actually finally talking about the importance of judges. So what is the Republican strategy at this point, given that so many young people are fired up? There was amazing video yesterday of students at the University of Wisconsin in these long lines to vote. I mean, things have changed since 2010. What is the Republican strategy around these issues today?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that gerrymandering is such a big deal because it allows politicians to ignore or nullify the will of the voters more than any other tactic out there. And so this is something that Republicans were keenly aware of in 2010, and Democrats have been trying for a decade and a half now to try to roll back. And in some places they've done it very successfully. And in some places like Wisconsin, they're closer than before, but they haven't done it yet. And it's hard because once a party entrenches their power, it's very difficult to try to roll that back. I think that Republicans are going to try to figure out what else they can do to try to nullify the will of the people. I mean, that's why you already hear Republicans saying that they're going to try to potentially impeach Judge Protasiewicz, which again, I think would be unprecedented. And I'm not sure that's something they can actually pull off, but they're talking about it for a reason, which is they're trying to figure out ways that they can continue to entrench their power. But I think at some point they're going to face a question of, can they keep nominating candidates that are out of step with the changing demographics and policy preferences of the voters? You know, there's been chances for Wisconsin Republicans not to nominate necessarily moderate candidates, but less extreme candidates, and they haven't done so. And so they continually nominate the most extreme candidates possible. They continue to do the most extreme things possible, and they wonder why they're having this result. I mean, there was a reason why some of the smarter minds in the Republican Party didn't want the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade, right? Because they knew that it was going to make a lot of people angry. And that's not the only thing that has led to changes in politics in Wisconsin, but it's been a major motivating factor that people feel like the judiciary has been a key driver of taking away their rights, and they have to focus more on the courts if they want to restore their rights. That is something that conservatives have understood very well over the last 50 years, and Democrats and progressives have been slow to understand the same consequences of the judiciary.
Just to give people a little more information about how significant this race was in Wisconsin, as you report, Dan Kelly, the conservative who was running to sit on the Supreme Court, called Medicare and Medicaid forms of involuntary servitude. He said gay marriage will rob the institution of marriage of any discernible meaning. He compared affirmative action to the moral equivalent of slavery. He said abortion is a policy that has as its primary purpose harming children. Those are just a couple examples. And then Ari, you tell this incredible story. This is how you open your piece, talking about how important this race was last night. On December 12, 2020, a day after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit filed by Texas that sought to void the presidential election results in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Supreme Court heard a separate challenge by Donald Trump's campaign that aimed to throw out 221,000 votes cast in the state's two most Democratic counties. It was the only state Supreme Court in the country to hold a hearing on Trump's effort to overturn the election. This is a wild story. Can you just give us an overview of this?
Yeah, and it failed by one vote. I mean, wow. Basically what happened was a day after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Trump's attempt to overturn the election, the Wisconsin Supreme Court was the only state Supreme Court in the country to hear a challenge to Trump's election. They only challenged votes in Madison and Milwaukee, the most Democratic areas of the state. They challenged 220,000 votes, which was more than 10 times Joe Biden's margin of victory. And the only reason it failed was because one of the conservative justices, who's sometimes a swing judge, voted with the three liberal justices. Otherwise, if there had been an airtight conservative majority, they would have voted to overturn the election in Wisconsin. And that would have plunged the state and the nation into a constitutional crisis. A lot of people think about the election. They said, oh, Donald Trump lost 60 times in court. It was all kind of a joke. He never actually came that close to overturning the results. Well, in Wisconsin, he came very close to overturning the results. And I think that really heightened the importance of this contest. People were very aware of that. And not only that, but Dan Kelly, who was not at the court on the time, criticized the conservative swing justice that upheld the election. And then Kelly actually campaigned with people that were part of the insurrection and took a lot of money from people that questioned the outcome of the election, that funded election denialism. So Kelly was extreme even by conservative standards. He wasn't just a conservative. He was actively aligning with the insurrectionist wing of the party. I think that made a lot of people really, really nervous that this guy is not just going to enshrine a conservative majority, but he's going to enshrine a deeply undemocratic majority that could try to overturn future elections. And that was the exact thing that voters rejected in 2022 in many states. And I think it was refreshing to see them rejected again.
Right. Because worst case scenario, Trump runs again and does the same exact thing in 2024.
Exactly. And even though the balance of power on the court would still be conservative, maybe they make a more palatable argument to the other conservative swing justice and they succeed where they failed. So the fact that, you know, the nation's highest, one of the most important state courts in the country will no longer have a majority that could try to overturn an election. I mean, that's a major bullet that was dodged for 2024.
Ari Berman is national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones, a fellow at the Type Media Center, and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. You can find Ari's latest pieces for Mother Jones at yourcallradio.org. Ari, thank you so much for your important reporting, all of the really amazing detail in your pieces, and thank you for joining us.
Always great to talk to you. Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will look at the makeup of judges across the country. President Biden has appointed 105 federal judges, outpacing Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to discuss nationwide school walkouts to demand action on gun control. These walkouts are happening right now. I'm just looking online right now. A number of headlines. In Nashville, students have been walking out for several days. They've been flooding the Capitol to demand some kind of gun control after last week's horrific school shooting, which left three children and three adults dead. And so far, it looks like there are walkouts all across the country. So we are going to talk about that tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Now we're going to talk about the makeup of judges across the country. President Biden has appointed 105 federal judges, outpacing Trump, Obama, and Bush, according to ABC. Jake Falaschini is legal director of state courts and program director for justice at the Alliance for Justice, a national association of more than 150 organizations advocating for a fair and independent justice system and preserving access to the courts. Hi, Jake. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be on with you today.
Well, it's great to have you. So Alliance for Justice spent almost $75,000 on the Wisconsin race, educating voters about why the race was so important. What are your thoughts on the outcome? This was a huge victory for progressives on the Supreme Court.
It was. I couldn't be more excited. It really was a fantastic outcome, I think, for the people of Wisconsin and in fact for the entire nation, because now we have the opportunity for democracy to at least have a fighting chance in Wisconsin for the first time in more than a decade.
You know, you're a lawyer and a policy advocate. You focus on federal, state, and local justice systems. And I just wonder overall, what are your thoughts about the changes that we're seeing in terms of the money that's being spent to elect judges? Especially like the Federalist Society and Leonard Leo, these extreme conservative rulings that we're seeing in the Supreme Court. Just what are your thoughts about, you know, the changes that we've seen in the last couple of decades?
I mean, that's such a complicated question. In many ways, I mean, look at the results in Wisconsin, right, which show that for the election yesterday, we're expecting the total voter turnout of registered voters in Wisconsin to be close to 40%. That greatly outpaces even the highest turnout in any other state Supreme Court election in history in Wisconsin. I think the next highest was 34% in 2011. And we saw a huge influx of money that went into educating voters about the importance of that race and their need to get out and vote and their rights that were at stake. If at the end of the day, the money that's pouring into these elections is used to educate voters about why these races are so important, the rights, their rights that are at stake, and why they should be voting in these elections, then I don't see that as a bad thing. But if this money is unconstrained and it's being used to manipulate voters and is used to, to further negative messaging and advertising, then it can be a bad thing. So I think it's really complicated. And, right. You know, we need to be careful about how we as a public are stepping into, stepping into these state Supreme Court elections and electing justices. But I don't necessarily think that just electing justices is a bad thing. To your question about kind of the bigger picture, you know, it's scary what's happening. And I think most Americans feel that way. They feel like their rights are at stake. They feel like, you know, protections that they've had for decades are being stripped away by an unresponsive and, you know, political Supreme Court. And I think that scares a lot of people. And the result in Wisconsin shows that they're ready to fight back.
And I think a lot of people are waking up to the fact that judges have so much power. On the Democratic side, they just haven't spent that much effort on judges. I mean, that has definitely changed. But just hearing you talk makes me think about the federal judge Matthew Kaczmarek out of Texas, a conservative Christian who has the power. This one man is going to have the power over whether abortion pills remain legal or illegal. I really thought we'd get the decision by now, but we're still waiting on that.
That's a great example. When Matthew Kaczmarek, when his nomination came up for the federal judicial position in the Northern District of Texas, at the time, I was at the Center for American Progress, also working on federal judges. And we rang the alarm there about the fact that he was aligned with Christian nationalists, that his former work before getting on the bench was as a Christian nationalist movement lawyer, even slightly neutral in his positions. He advertised them openly. And the Alliance for Justice, I wasn't at the organization at the time, wrote a stunning report on his background and why he would be not fair and not partial were he to get the lifetime appointment to the bench. And it turns out that he's done exactly what the Center for American Progress and the Alliance for Justice and other organizations that have been involved in these courts fights for a long time said that he would do. And I think the country is finally waking up to the fact that for the past 30 years, Republicans have tried to politicize both the federal and the state courts, and they've done a very good job at it. Mm-hmm. And it is time for Democrats and liberals and progressives to wake up and stop seeing the courts as being fair and impartial, because they will only be as fair and impartial as we force them to be.
Right. And it's so important to focus again on Leonard Leo, who spent three decades working mostly behind the scenes to pull the judiciary to the right. He's the guy who comes up with the list of Supreme Court nominees, and he handed them over to Donald Trump, and they got exactly what they wanted. Before we go and move on and talk about President Biden's judges, we have one caller who has a comment. Oh, he just dropped. This is actually an interesting point. Max in Berkeley said that he's grateful that Dan Kelly was honest about his positions, because so many Republican politicians in Congress lie about what they stand for. What's interesting, though, about Kelly is he actually didn't say much, based on the reporting I heard from NPR, about where he stood. But people like Ari Berman at Mother Jones really exposed what he has said in the past and the positions that he has taken in the past. And yet, also, people really talked about the fact that Judge Janet Podasiewicz was very honest about where she stood, which is fairly unusual for judges. So what are your thoughts on this?
It's a great question. I love Ari's reporting. I was so happy to hear him on your program before I was able to jump on. He's truly doing amazing work exposing, how judicial candidates and others, you know, what their real positions on issues are, even if they aren't openly saying it in public. I think you're right. Dan Kelly actually was quite cagey about his positions. He used code words that I think we all associate with conservative positions from the bench, like originalism and textualism, quote. And he called himself a judicial conservative. And then he allowed conservatives to interpret what that meant as far as the types of outcomes that he would have in cases, because conservatives have been really good about coding those words to mean particular outcomes from the bench for the past 30 years. And part of what progressives have not been so great about is creating a similar set of coding on our side, where, you know, judges say things like progressive constitutionalism, and that means something to voters and to others about what kinds of actual outcomes are going to happen in those cases, like an expansion of democratic rights, like a protection of our fundamental rights to bodily.
Yes, I think we lost you first. You're fine. Go ahead.
So sorry. No, you know, I agree with you. I don't think that Dan Kelly actually was all that honest about it. I do think that Judge Protasiewicz was more open about her positions. And part of the reason was because she needed to be, because the progressive movement hasn't done as good of a job to describe what it means to be a progressive judge or justice on the bench.
Well, when we put this show together, it just made me think about judges and what's happening across the country now that President Biden has been in power for a few years. Before we talk about President Biden's judges, let's just talk about what we saw under the Trump administration. The New Republic reports that with the help of Mitch McConnell, they were able to confirm a whopping 234 federal judges. Trump judges, and I'm reading from this piece, were often underqualified ideologues rubber-stamped by the right-wing Federalist Society. Trump's mostly white male judicial confirmees have since been responsible for a number of decisions to undermine voting rights, civil rights, immigration, and student loan relief, issues that disproportionately impact communities of color. I have to say, whenever I hear the talking heads on the cable shows say that, you know, Trump didn't get much done or the Republicans don't have a plan in place, I think, oh, no, look at the judges. I mean, that alone, they got so much done. So can you just remind us what they were able to accomplish in the Trump administration when it comes to judges?
I mean, I think you hit those stats really well. Basically, in his 4 years on the bench, Trump was able to replace almost a third of the federal judiciary. And these are lifetime appointments. These are judges that, if they so choose, they can stay in these positions until they die. And many of these judicial appointments on their side were movement lawyers. And so these are folks who have very strong ideological positions that they are trying to enact from the bench. Given that, I don't think they're likely to retire anytime soon. You know, they're not going to take the payout to go to a big law firm or go to, you know, some other position, you know, an academic position afterwards, and take senior status and open one of those positions up. So I think these folks are going to be on the bench for a really long time. Thankfully, under the Biden administration, we've actually seen a really similar prioritization of judges as being incredibly important for President Biden's overall agenda. And in just 2 years, President Biden has managed to keep pace with the Trump administration's judicial appointments. The Biden administration in 2 years and change has now appointed 119 federal lifetime judges. Those are, you know, folks who, albeit mostly in Democratic states, are going to make a real impact on the law and our rights over time. And if Biden keeps this prioritization, our Senate leadership keeps this prioritization with a now expanded majority in the Senate, then they have a real opportunity to appoint even more federal judges over the next 2 years and, you know, come close to, if not match, the total number of appointments that Trump made in his 4 years.
Let's talk a little bit about why this is so important and the diversity of these judges. For the New Republic in February, Pablo Manriquez, this was on February 14th, The U.S. Senate voted 54-45 to confirm Gina Mendez Miro, a district judge for Puerto Rico. Mendez Miro makes history as both the first LGBTQ judge to serve on the island's court and the 100th of President Biden's judicial nominees confirmed by the Senate for a lifetime appointment. 76 of the 100 judges the Senate has confirmed during Biden's presidency have been women. 76 out of 100 are women. 68 have been people of color. These have included a number of historic firsts, like Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first Black woman to sit on the Supreme Court, Zahid Qureshi, the first Muslim to serve as federal judge, Sunshine Suzanne Sykes, the first indigenous federal judge, Beth Robinson, the first LGBTQ woman to serve on any federal circuit court, Tiffany Cunningham, the first Black federal circuit judge, and Lucy Ko, the first Korean American to serve as a federal appeals court judge, among others. We could just keep going down the list, Jake. Can you tell us why this is so important?
I can. And I think it, you know, hopefully it's obvious to most of your listeners, but the judiciary relies upon relies upon the people actually believing that what judges are saying is fair and just and independent. They don't have the power of the purse. They don't have the power of the sword. They have the power of the imagination and of belief. And if the judiciary does not look like or actually represent the people that it's serving, then people do not have faith that the outcomes and the decisions that the judiciary are making are actually fair and just. And that's hugely important for the public to actually understand that and believe that. And so, you know, we've got a lot to make up for, you know, with 200 years in America of zero representation for many of our minority populations. And unfortunately, Republican administrations have not made much progress on that front. And so it really comes down to Democratic administrations to make more progress on that. The Obama administration was record-breaking in the number of diverse appointments that it made. But the Biden administration has blown even those records completely out of the water with many of the statistics that you talked about and many of the historic first appointments that you spoke about. And, you know, we're very grateful for all of those. We really, truly, they are spectacular, but there's still lots of glass ceilings to break. There are lots of concrete ceilings to break, and we can't let up. We absolutely have to continue to press this administration to make even more appointments in areas that still haven't been greatly represented on the bench, like folks with experience in professionally diverse areas of the law, like labor law, consumer rights protection, environmental law. There are still a lot of areas out there where we need better representation on the bench. We need more movement lawyers, quite honestly. Right. We need more lawyers who have protected and defended the rights that conservative judges are attacking without fail from the bench. And we need lawyers who have been in those fights, in litigation, who understand the rights that they're trying to protect, that they can do it from the bench as well. So we need more movement lawyers on the bench as well.
We talked briefly about the decision we are expecting any day now from the federal judge, Matthew Kaczmarek, in terms of whether or not he's going to overturn the legality of the abortion pill. Are there any other cases you've been following that we need to know about that might not have received enough media attention?
Oh, there are a lot that are percolating. There are several gun violence prevention laws that are being undermined in the states right now through litigation in the federal courts that, you know, could do a lot of harm to the American public. We're already suffering an epidemic of gun violence and without even the current protections that are in place that are being undermined by the Supreme Court's precedent in Heller and the progeny cases, that could get even worse. More people will die. And so there are cases that have been percolating through the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit that would do even more to undermine state and local authority to pass common sense gun violence prevention laws. And we will likely see way more of those going up into the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court over the next year or two. Affirmative action, I think, is really on the chopping block right now. And that's, you know, hugely sad. You know, we have the case in the Supreme Court right now, and we'll see what the outcome is in June. But we could see even more attacks there. And LGBTQ rights are truly at stake. We've got the case coming up in the Supreme Court this term that will determine whether or not private business owners are able to discriminate against LGBTQ people because of their status. And that is exceptionally scary. And I think that opens the door to even more attacks on LGBTQ rights in the federal courts in the years ahead.
We have a question from Aaron who says, I just learned from Indivisible a week ago that Democrats in the Senate are still respecting the blue slip objections of Republican senators, even though under Mitch McConnell, no blue slip objections were honored from Democratic senators. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, I can. And that's a really great point. I meant to bring it up earlier. So I'm glad that your caller is so well informed. There's a long historic tradition called the blue slip, which basically is granted. It's changed a lot over time when it was first kind of came into effect in the early 1900s. And it was meant as a tool to give senators some input on the federal judges from their home states. In order to, you know, let them, you know, have some input with the White House about which appointments those were going to be. Those were mostly meant to just kind of be informative, not meant to be a veto. But over time, it kind of grew into a veto, a de facto veto rule for home state senators that they could just say, no, I'm not going to sign this slip. It's literally just a blue slip of paper that says, yes, go ahead and start to process this nominee. And Mitch McConnell changed that for courts of appeals judges and said that, you know, he wasn't going to honor the blue slip anymore for courts of appeals judges, but he did continue to mostly honor it for district court judges under the threat that he would get rid of it if Democrats abused it. And so Democrats continued mostly to sign off on their blue slips and didn't really abuse the process. It has historically over time been completely weaponized more by Republicans, and it is definitely being weaponized more now under the Biden administration by Republicans than Democrats ever weaponized the blue slip during Republican administrations. And, you know, we've taken the position at the Alliance for Justice that that Democrats need to do away with the blue slip. They need to no longer honor it. They need to put forward great nominees from Republican states. And if they're not going to submit their blue slips, then so be it. They should continue to process those nominees. I agree with your caller that it's time for change here, that Democrats really need to wake up to the fact that Republicans are not going to use this in good faith. We have a great example from just this week. There was a nominee from Mississippi that got sign off from one of the two Republican senators there. The other Republican senator who came out and endorsed Donald Trump yesterday, in the exact same day, also said that she wasn't going to submit her blue slip for this really moderate nominee from down there. And now the question is really up to Senate Democrats as to whether or not they're going to continue to process this nominee even without her having returned her blue slip. And I think that they should. It's right. time to move forward. We can't let Republicans obstruct these seats anymore.
Just quickly, because we're almost out of time, the only article I could find on this is from January in the Washington Post. Senators prepare for a showdown over judges and blue slips. Have there been any updates since then?
I think that most of these conversations are happening kind of in the background right now. And there is a fire smoldering. I think we'll probably see more around the summertime if, you know, a fire really emerges from it. Because at this point, you know, if Democrats are going to decide to move forward on the blue slip and put forward nominees, even without them having their blue slips, we need more nominees out of the White House for those positions to actually call the question. And then, you know, Democrats have to be prepared to have the time to process them all and get them through committee and get them votes on the floor by the end of the Biden administration. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to blow up the process if you're not going to actually make use of it. So I think, you know, the time is really coming for Democrats to get serious about this and make a decision. I think we'll see in the next 3 months whether or not they're going to do that.
Where does the Alliance for Justice stand on expanding the Supreme Court? Ellie Mistal, the justice correspondent for The Nation, has been on the show saying that if we do not expand the Supreme Court, the next 30 years of U.S. law will be decided by six ultra-right judges. What are your thoughts on that? And we have about a minute left. Well, sorry about that.
No, not at all. This is such a great question to end on. And of
okay,
course,
a minute and 30. Some... Sorry.
To end with a thought from Ellie is always a highlight of my day because I love him so much. But he's right. He's absolutely right. We have to expand the Supreme Court. But it's not the only thing that we need to do. There are many reforms that need to be made to the Supreme Court and to our federal courts. We need to expand the lower courts. Mm-hmm. We need ethics and transparency measures that apply to our Supreme Court justices. We need term limits for justices. And at the end of the day, you know, none of this is going to make a difference if we don't also expand the Supreme Court. And so, yes, we should be looking at legislation that will do that as well.
Well, Jake, you've been a great guest. We'd love to have you back to talk about some of the other changes that you'd like to see with the courts, just given how important they are. And we know that, you know, Republicans are brilliant at this. They introduce laws they know are unconstitutional, knowing that they're going to go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Right? So it's so important. Thank you so much for joining us. Jake Falaschini is Legal Director of State Courts and Program Director for Justice at the Alliance for Justice, a national association of more than 150 organizations advocating for a fair and independent justice system and preserving access to the courts. Thanks so much, Jake. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks to BSol for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find today's show and past shows at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our podcast there. And we hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. We are going to talk about the nationwide student walkouts calling for gun control. They're happening right now, probably in your area. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.